You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's more than football happening at tonight's NFL preseason game in San Diego. This is the first time 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick will play since he refused to stand for the national anthem. He says he's taking this action to protest racism in a country he says oppresses black people and people of color.
No, this country stands for freedom, liberty, justice for all. And it's not happening for all right now.
Kaepernick's protest is the newest chapter in the long-evolving history of our country's national anthem, and it's bringing forth fresh criticism that the national anthem is itself racist. With us now is University of Michigan music history professor Mark Clegg, a musicologist who's writing a book on the Star-Spangled Banner, has been deeply involved in studying the national anthem. Good to have you back with us, Mark.
Thanks, Cindy. It's great to be here.
An opinion piece, Mark, that we saw on TheRoot.com by Jason Jackson caught our eye, and then there have been many more along this line, making the argument that the national anthem is, and this is in his words, one of the most racist, pro-slavery, anti-black songs in the American lexicon. And as I say, there have been other writers making the same point. But your opinion piece on CNN.com today says the anthem's critics are missing the point in the anthem, and you say in no way glorifies or celebrates slavery. What do you think critics like Jackson are missing here?
Well, I mean, at first I should say that I really am grateful to Kaepernick for bringing attention to this issue and bringing sort of the complexity and sort of crisscrossing history of the United States to the fore. So, you know, I don't mean to diminish the real pain that I think many people right now are feeling, that this anthem doesn't represent them or that the land of the free is not their land of the free. And so there is a real danger when we sort of push around symbols like the flag or the song, the Star-Spangled Banner, that we do it in a kind of rote way without really thinking about what it represents and who it represents and who has the right to sing it. And, you know, so for me, someone like Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock, you know, makes a powerful statement with the Star-Spangled Banner. But part of what he's saying is, this is my song too. This is a song of youth. This is a song of an African-American.
So, or when Jose Feliciano sang it at the World Series in Detroit in 1968.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
So it's a complex issue, and I don't mean to belittle that in any way. But I do think that the question of the third verse in particular, the phrase hireling and slave that's getting people upset, is being blown out of proportion in the sense that I don't think the song in any way is racist or that it is certainly not the most racist song in American history.
All right. I mean, well, let's get into this not often heard third stanza, because I think honestly most of us don't get, you know, when we're out, you hear verse one and then let the Red Wings game begin. I think for most people that's kind of it, and a lot of people have not gone deep. So here's this third verse. And where is that band who so vauntingly swore that the havoc of war and the battle's confusion, a home and a country, should leave us no more? Their blood has washed out their foul footsteps' pollution. No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. And the Star-Spangled Banner in triumph doth wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. So there are some who are accusing Francis Scott Key of celebrating the death of black runaway slaves, the ones in the British colonial marines who joined the British to fight for the British in exchange for their freedom. So what is the history here?
So there are four verses to the Star-Spangled Banner, and you're absolutely right. We basically sing the first one, and no one really knows the other three. But all four are part of Key's original statement, which is in response to the Battle of Baltimore in 1814. And he, in the middle two verses, so really two and three, is vilifying the British enemy. I mean, they're the enemy. They've invaded the country. I mean, it's the fear that was running through the United States at this time, which, you know, we sometimes call our second war of independence, was palpable. And most people expected the British to win at Baltimore. I mean, Francis Scott Key himself had been in the militia at Washington when probably the most ignominious moment in our history, when the British burned the federal buildings to the ground. So this was a time of real terror for Key, for his family that was living in Georgetown at this time, and a real crisis point for America. So with this victory, which Key himself saw as sort of miraculous, he really sees that British enemy as, you know, something to be vilified, something to be criticized. And he's disillusioned himself as someone who was culturally British. His great-grandfather was British, as sort of been betrayed by the English. I mean, he was pro-English himself, and then, you know, to be attacked and sort of, you know, there was sort of looting and pillaging and fear that was running through the American, you know, nation at this time. And so both of those stanzas, or verses two and three, vilify the enemy. the enemy at this point is both black and white. I mean, it's white sort of mercenaries, professional soldiers, and it's black escaped slaves who the British had promised, mm-hmm. you know, as they did actually in the Revolutionary War. But the good thing is they did fulfill this promise in the War of 1812. And those who fought for the colonial Marines, the African-American men and their families, were then later transported to Trinidad and Halifax. So they were, in fact, freed. One thing we're missing, however, is that there were also African-Americans, both escaped slaves, free blacks, and actually slaves who were fighting on the American side as well. Mm-hmm. So when Key writes a poem in praise of the heroes who have defended Fort McHenry and defended the city, he's actually doing this irregardless of color. There are blacks and whites on the American side as well. So that's, I think, an important part of the detail of the history that we have to understand. For Key, it's not that the blacks are bad, the slaves are bad, and the whites are good.
It's the British.
There are whites and blacks on both sides of the war.
And as you point in your piece on CNN.com, the opening line of verse 4, "Oh, thus be it ever, when free men shall stand between their loved home and the war's desolation."
Yeah, and I think that word freeman is really a technical term for Key. I mean, he's a lawyer. Mm-hmm. He's actually arguing cases really on both sides of the issue. He's supporting, you know, representing slave owners at times, and he's actually representing free blacks who are recaptured and sort of sold back into slavery illegally. And this is something that Key was working against in his own legal practice. But he works both sides of it. And I think for him, he's making a kind of moral compromise where I think he doesn't believe in slavery, but he also is following the law.
Although he owned slaves.
He did own slaves himself, and he also freed four of those slaves. So his own attitudes about slavery are pretty complex and contradictory, and they're not all that different from George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and the Founding Fathers, who were sort of struggling with these issues. So that's really, you know, morally unjustifiable to limit universal human rights to just one group of people. And our whole history is wrapped up into this question of expanding that notion of who is a citizen, who is human, who gets to vote, who gets to marry. And I think one of the things I loved about the way you introduced this is the song and the country have really changed over time, and we can reinvent that song. The way we sing it today doesn't have to be with the same mindset that Francis Scott Key sang it. I think one of the surprising things to me about Key, and I've wrestled with this personally for a long time because I love the song, and you know, how do you love this song and how do you study this when it's such volatile, you know, information? But you know, part of it is that Key himself, for the time, was pretty progressive. I mean, he had seven slaves. He released some of them voluntarily. He volunteered and helped put together a school for free black children. He volunteered his legal services on, you know, defending free blacks who had been stolen back into slavery. He, you know, represented a lot of things that today we would see as progressive or, mm-hmm. you know, anti-slavery. But he wasn't an abolitionist. I think for him, he really feared what would happen to the country if all this change happened too soon. And, you know, many people were making that kind of moral compromise. And I don't apologize for Francis Scott Key or anyone for that compromise. But to call the Star-Spangled Banner inherently racist when it's really something that's celebrating American military heroes, both black and white, written by a guy who himself was on the more progressive side of history. He wasn't innocent, but he's not entirely guilty in the way that I think some of the discourse, you know, on the web right now is representing him as. And so the contradictions and the complexities and the problems with the song are really part of its magic and part of why we need to grapple with it and really know this history. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I was in elementary school, we didn't talk about Key owning slaves. And I think we probably should. We need to remember this history. We need to remember where we came from so that we can be vigilant about where we're going.
University of Michigan musicologist Mark Clegg, always great to have you on the program. Mark, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I love coming.